Who's that stranger in the corner? Is it me at 17? Trying on his dad's fedora, quoting films he's never seen. Trying to like the taste of whiskey, trying to like the way I sing. Playing songs I've long forgotten, a reminder to be kinder to the boy who knew more than I give him credit for. He knew there was magic in the major seven. If you can open up your heart, don't have to try so hard not to be caught out trying. It's only sentimental if you don't believe in it. Magic in the major seven. If you can open up your heart, don't have to try so hard not to be caught out trying. It's only sentimental if you don't believe in it. And I wanna believe again. Once I dreamt in Technicolor, I guess growing up means going gray. Turning down the saturation helps me make it through the day. And I've been trying not to get my hopes up, 'cause hope's a target on your chest. So why am I crying in the kitchen?
Hello and welcome to the Holmes Movies Podcast. I'm Adam Holmes, not the person you're used to hearing as the first voice in this show. But it's my job today to introduce the program, because this is the Movies and Me episode, where we interview a special guest. And today it's my special guest, my dear friend of many, 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 many thousands of years, Edward Randall, is with us to talk about his four favorite films, but also to chat about his latest project, which is a full-length album of brilliant tunes, which is shortly being released, shortly to be released in just a few weeks, right? Early May?
That's right. I think May the 17th is when it's going to drop on streaming services.
May the 17th be with you. So that's coming soon. You can already watch some of Ed's music videos from this album, and you can take in a ton of Ed's other musical content in all sorts of places: Bandcamp, Spotify, YouTube, because Ed's been a musician for a long time now, both as an individual singer-songwriter, but also as a member of the astonishingly long-lived group, the Swingle Singers, who are name-checked in no less of a show than The West Wing, and who've been gracing people's ears since the 1960s, but not obviously in the same iteration. Ed also, this is a movie podcast. His career intersects with the world of Hollywood, not just in the aforementioned mention in the West Wing series, but Ed, as some of you may know, if you're really sort of deep Harry Potter nerds, was in the second Harry Potter movie, where he played Justin Finch Fletchley and was petrified by the basilisk. The basilisk, right.
The snake thing.
Yeah, which, happened relatively early in our friendship, but didn't cause too much strife. I mentioned that because one of the other people who was up for that role was me. I'm happy. I'm fine. Got my podcast.
I remember. I was doing a pantomime in London. I don't know if you remember this, Adam.
Yeah, sure. Everyone did showbiz but me. Yeah, great.
Yeah, yeah. It was a pantomime of the Jack and the Beanstalk story, and a lot. I think there was two people who were in the group that I was with, because they had like the different groups of like kids, and they would swap them around over 3 or 4 days. But anyway, there was one of them asked me, "Were you in Harry Potter?" Because a lot of people thought I was the guy who played Colin Creevy, the one with the photo. The camera,
A lot of people. You do look a bit like him, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know the
Harry, I thought, sorry, have you messed up your own anecdote? Wasn't there an actual Harry Potter person in your play?
There was, yeah. It was the, what was his name?
Wouldn't he play one of the idiots who follows Draco Malfoy around or something?
Oh, yeah, he played Goyle, or what was his name?
Right, okay, we've successfully derailed Ed's intro here. I just wanted to say that since starring in the second Harry Potter film and, you know, doing brilliantly.
Jamie Whalen, Wyler, that was his name.
For fuck's sake. hi, Jamie, if you're listening. Ed has continued his involvement in the movie biz, but like from the musical angle. So he is a regular session singer who has recorded film scores, you know, such as you know, he's appeared on the No Time to Die score, Cruella, Raya and the Last Dragon. Don't know what that is. The Marvels, Guardians of the Galaxy 3, Doctor Strange, Don't Look Up, sequel to Don't Look Now, The Conjuring 2, and the Jurassic World series.
Shout out to Raya and the Last Dragon. It's a great film, actually.
It's really good.
One of those films that kind of missed out on a cinema release because of COVID, but it was it's a beautiful, beautiful Disney film.
Okay, I'll check it out. Arsenal's goalkeeper was called David Raya, so there you go. And Ed also co-wrote a song for the film Downsizing with Matt Damon. So I just wanted to read those credits because they're really cool and give you a sense of what Ed's up to. So yeah, Ed, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I feel like I've been chipping in before my time, but hello. Nice to see you.
Before we launch into discussing four of your favorite films, can you tell us a little bit about this album that's coming out and what have we got to look forward to?
So I have been making my debut singer-songwriter album. I've made a couple of EPs before, but this is the first full-length thing. It's called Homing Instinct. And I realized as I was writing the songs that there was this theme of home in a kind of literal and broader sense, hence the title. Songs about kind of being in a more of a domestic stage of life, having traveled the world quite a bit, doing music and just kind of nesting and roosting at home and wanting to write about that. But also kind of in the music that I was writing, I found that I was kind of daring to go with my instincts and my kind of first thought, best thought, you know, I think it's very easy to kind of overthink when you're writing and try and be cool or try and sound like someone other than yourself. But I was really trying to sound like myself with these songs. So that's kind of the other reason it's called that. And it's very inspired by kind of my favorite 70s singer-songwriters, Carole King, but Bacharach, you know, that kind of sound world. But also I co-produced it with a guy called Chris Heisen, who's got a fantastic kind of quite modern production sensibility. So yeah, I'm really, really proud of it. And I'm looking forward to kind of talking around it in the context of films, which has been kind of fun to think about if and how it intersects with my love of films. Which is not something I'd really thought about before.
Yeah, I do a playlist sharing project with our mutual friend Andrew, who sent me a film by a US indie group today that was called Tarkovsky. Sent me a song that was called Tarkovsky, and it was obviously about the Ukrainian/Soviet filmmaker and it was just one of these things where they were crowbarring all these clever references to his films into the lyrics of this song. I just had to turn it off. I was like, I can't. Mm-hmm. This is so annoying. This feels like it's been written by the worst people that you're at university with. But it sort of prompted me to think, like, have you ever sat down at the piano or with your guitar and thought, like, as you write this song, it doesn't have to be about a particular film, but like, are your mental images, as you know, for example, as you write my favorite song that you've played me on the recent album, the Major Seventh, is all about looking back to teenage years but very much consciously as the person you are now and sort of in conversation with that younger self. And I feel like there's such a because when we go into sort of the world of memory, we sort of immediately go into something that it has been in some ways consigned to the visual and edited and sort of, you know, so do you see where I'm getting at? Do you sort of think in any way sort of cinematically when you write?
There's a lyric in that song that you referenced, the song's called Magic M7. There's a line, once I dreamt in Technicolor, I guess growing up means going gray. And that I think is like, I guess I took that lyric from a kind of Wizard of Oz, Matter of Life and Death kind of use of color. I definitely think visually when I'm writing lyrics, and also a lot of the conversations we were having, I was having with my co-producer Chris, were kind of, we were thinking visually. He's actually a sometime film composer, so he's a very visual kind of music maker, and I love kind of big cinematic orchestrations in my arrangements. So strings and harp and horns, like all of these things, I think my love of those timbres has partly come from my love of film music. It's kind of there in the background as something I'm thinking about. I also think that some of the best lyrics, like good lyric writing, is often, I think, very very visual. You know, it's not just cerebral or kind of it playing with the sounds of words. It's also conjuring images. So one of my heroes, Tom Waits,
says,
like,
love him.
Songs are like, yeah, he says, like, songs are like movies for the ears. And
songs are like movies for the ears.
Oh, Tom. Hi, Tom. He's joined the Zoom call.
Yeah, and he's here tonight.
Yeah. It's there, but it's also, it's more of a kind of general sensibility than specific references on the whole, I think.
I like it. So I'm dying to know. What is your first pick?
Okay, well, I thought I would go obvious. I'd get this one out of the way early. So the film is The Princess Bride.
Yes.
Which
yes.
For the benefit of listeners,
knew you were gonna bring that one up.
Yeah. So for the benefit of listeners, I was involved in Adam's wedding. I officiated the ceremony. And Anders was the best man. And so we both had to, like, say some words at the wedding. And I think we had to sort of agree beforehand on who was going to make the Princess Bride references. It's one of those films.
It fell to Anders, by the way, just in case anyone was in any doubt about that.
The obvious one being Marriage.
Marriage.
So The Princess Bride, I talked about how my album is about home, and this movie just, like, is home to me. It just is the ultimate comfort viewing, and it's one of those films where I've seen it so many times that I have almost no sense anymore of, like, whether it's any good or, like, I kind of know it's good, but when I watch it, I'm watching it overlaid with all the previous times I watched it, and there's absolutely no kind of objectivity. Not that objectivity is ever really possible with art, but it's just like part of my personality, it's part of my vernacular, and I love it.
I know exactly the phenomenon you're describing, and I don't think I'm there with Princess Bride, because I think I've only seen it 5 or 6 times, and I think you could multiply that by 10 and get close to the number of times you've seen it. But there are films, famously in our case, me and Anders's case, The Big Lebowski is one of them, where you become so familiar with it that you are incapable of going through a day without, I am incapable of going through a day without referencing that film, or without thinking in some form about, you know, whether it's in a professional context, you know, make an in-joke to myself, or whether, you know, I just randomly quote it to my long-suffering spouse, or whether it, you know, comes up in the course of interaction with someone else who's seen the film, in which case you just go down this rabbit hole of quoting endless, more and more sort of obscure and specific lines. And I think that's one of the things that's so great about Princess Bride is its quotability.
Yes.
And that it's it's a delightful romp, and you know, completely and utterly charming in every way that it needs to be, and doesn't would have done its job had a perfectly workable sort of Disney style script with a few good laughs, and everyone could pat themselves on the back and go home. But the fact that it is this like tumble of just hilarious writing and brilliant delivery from everyone is just
one of those films that there's nothing about it that I would change. There's the everything about it works. It's like it's funny. Everyone is well cast, especially actors like Mandy Patinkin, Chris Sarandon, Andre the Giant, Cary Elwes as well. Like, and even the Mark Knopfler music, I think, is
going to say the Knopfler music. I wouldn't change for the world. The first time I heard it, I was like, "What on earth?" But it's so perfect. It's so much of its time. Have you ever been tempted to like just a little bit, just like put some Knopfler in the backing of one of your just like a little bit of the Knopf?
So Mark Knopfler owns a studio in London, in Chiswick, called British Grove, which is a super pimped out studio that I've worked in a couple of times, including you mentioned Cruella. We recorded for the Cruella score in that studio, and I've that's the closest I've got to kind of just being in the Knopf vibe, trying to absorb it. It is really that's a great example of like I have no idea how that music would hit me if I were hearing it for the first time today. Like, I think it's in many ways like desperately cheesy, especially the sort of synth brass when the trumpeters come out on the balcony and they're like, they're playing the royal fanfare, and it's clearly just a kind of Casio synth patch.
But it's so identifiable as well. Like, I feel like if you heard it like in a shop or something, or just someone was playing it on like a Spotify, on shuffle on a playlist or something, you would be like, "Oh, Princess Bride!" It just makes you like fall back into wanting to watch the film again, or just into that world. Have you guys ever read or heard of Cary Elwes' book about the making of The Princess Bride?
A couple of my colleagues in the Swingles were as deep into it as me. And actually I should have worn it today. I own not one, but two novelty Princess Bride t-shirts.
Oh, nice.
One of which was a Secret Santa present from Joe in the Swingles. And she recommended the Cary Elwes book to me. I listened to it on audiobook when I was on tour, like walking around the streets of Italy. Of Ravenna, listening to this audiobook. Yeah, it's
we saw him in the Prince Charles Cinema in London once, and you were like,
"Go was look. That with you?" We went
was
to see
me,
Lawrence
and you were
Arabia.
Like, "Go look at that man," and I was like, oh, "Okay." And
go look at that man.
He's the problem is he's so like very handsome dude, but he's very now he's quite generic looking. He could be anyone. And
his cheekbones have softened over the years.
Right.
He had like a very Errol Flynn look about him, which I guess worked for the character.
Healthy Errol Flynn. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was in the line for the bar at Hartley. It was like a double feature at the Prince Charles. He was in line.
It
for the
was
bar.
Lawrence of Arabia in 70 mil, I think.
I'll never forget that. Yeah, that was. So there must have been a break. There was an intermission. And I did the thing of like, I looked at him from the side. I went and like stood at the other end of the room and sort of looked at him from there. And then I essentially had to go up and be like, and then I went back to Ed and I was like, I don't know who he is. And you just leaned over and was like, I'll say three words to you as you wish. And I was like, Jesus Christ. It was so... It was one of my best, one of my favorite sort of random celeb spots.
To his credit, he seems to just have such love for the film. I mean, he's not, his career has, I think he's worked steadily, but he's never done anything. He's never had like a big leading man role in the same way again, I don't think.
He's mainly been in like supporting roles. I mean, he was in the new Zack Snyder film on Netflix, Rebel Moon, and then he was also in the latest Mission Impossible film and everything. So he's been popping up, yeah. And I think he's also in the new Guy Ritchie film, the war movie.
I wonder if to some degree the sort of the fact that he is such a favorite from millennials' childhood has sort of brought him back in as a kind of reliable character actor. Because I worry that, you know, when I first watched Princess Bride, you know, I recognized him from the Mel Brooks movie Men in Tights. And I was like, this is a very, I mean, Princess Bride is infinitely superior to Men in Tights, but it's the same kind of cinematic universe of, you know,
it's
kind of
another Errol Flynn type.
Yeah. And I was wondering, I wonder if he painted himself into a bit of a corner there. But either way, he's, you know, total legend. I love the way he sort of embodies he has taken on the film as kind of a, not a cross to bear, but as something to celebrate. And he's a great example of doing that well. Oh, it is such a nice film to think about. And just like,
yeah. When I was watching Homeland, and then when I sort of looked up, because I really liked Mandy Patinkin in as his character Saul in Homeland, and then I was like, that's Inigo Montoya in The Princess Bride. That's him? Wow. And then I just realized that he's quite a versatile actor.
He's also brilliant on social media.
Yeah.
He and his wife did this like series of amazing homemade anti-Trump pro Biden campaign videos in 2020 where they would be like dancing around their kitchen.
Yeah,
they were really
that.
Creatively. They were really like wacky. And it was so sort of sweet. And they totally looked like people who could live in my area, sort of like faded hippies. Very, very fun. Anyway.
I love this one thing of Mandy Patinkin on YouTube. I can't remember what year it was. And he was on a talk show, and then halfway through, one of the hosts has to leave, and he's like, what's going on? It's like, oh, he's having a baby, he has to rush to the hospital. And he's like, oh my god, mazel tov, that's amazing. And he just becomes so wholesome, and he's like, is this his first child? Oh my god, that's so incredible, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
There do seem to have been a like overwhelming number of just good and nice people involved with the making of this film.
Yeah
Especially Andre the Giant as well. Like he got them like proper good food from like France when they were like just done with like most of the catering, and then he like imported a lot of like some good cheese.
I love it. Proper good food from like France. France.
I think they just got bored of like having curries or something for like the whole time when they were filming or something.
Ed has been trying to say something for like 10 minutes. And
sorry,
every time
I didn't mean to interrupt.
You steam in with another strange anecdote. Okay, Ed.
Oh, gosh. I guess I was just thinking about, firstly, there's lots of good anecdotes in the Kerry Elwes book, for sure, which I'm not going to try and remember all of them. But yeah, I would recommend you have to be big into the film. But I think if you are, it's worth a read. I think the thing that really stands out to me about The Princess Bride is just how bonkers the tone of it is. Like, it shouldn't work. It's very sincere and also very kind of flippant and silly, but with like a genuinely exciting sword fight, you know, like all of these things that kind of live together in the same film. And I think crowbar in a reference to my music, I think if I've taken anything from it subliminally, maybe it's the idea that you can kind of be a bit funny and silly and sincere and soppy and kind of like all of the above at once, and just kind of mash together things you like and hope that the tone coheres. You know, I think that's what I like to do, and I think the rewards of that are great, because you know, if you kind of, the Princess Bride is a great example of a film that, you know, people really go deep on and love and watch. You know, it didn't do particularly well at the box office, but then it just became this big VHS sensation because people would just watch it over and over again, and it would become, as it has for me, like part of their vocabulary. And I think that, you know, great music can do that as well. like you kind of get to know the sort of songwriting personality of somebody that you like, and you take all of the different weird tonal elements together. Yeah, I love it.
I feel like, I don't know, would you think if like the film was released today, do you think it would have the same impact, or would it work, or what do you think?
I think there are elements of it that are pretty dated. I mean, not flirt aside, I think the gender politics of it don't stand up, to be honest. Like, it would not pass the Bechdel test. The Buttercup is a pretty, like, that you just wouldn't write a female lead like that these days. She has kind of no agency, and like, it's a great performance by Robin Wright, but she doesn't have great material to work with, I would say. She does a lot of just being a damsel in distress. So I think that was part of the like issue maybe with why it didn't do well at the box office. Is it's called The Princess Bride, and it sounds like it's going to be a kind of movie for young girls, but it's not really like, yeah.
Quite the opposite.
It's
which I think quite that, yeah.
Quite movie plays with as well, with bloody Peter Falk is in this. Anyway, look,
yeah,
we can't monopolize the entire podcast on your first entry, much as that might be fun to do.
True. Okay.
So I'm gonna like, we just put cool a little time on Princess Bride for now, but
right.
We can always come back to it. What's your second film, Ed?
My second choice is Before Sunset, directed by Richard Linklater. I think this film was had a big influence on me. I watched it probably when I was 17 or 18 for the first time. When I'm talking about Before Sunset, I guess I'm also talking about Before Sunrise, which is the first film in the what is now a trilogy.
Yeah.
For people who don't know, there's two characters, Jesse played by Ethan Hawke and Celine played by Judy Delpy. And in the first movie, they meet on a train, they're sort of interrailing through Europe, and they meet on a train and kind of fancy each other and decide to get off the train at Vienna and just spend the night walking around, getting to know each other. And so the first film is just about that. It's about this kind of magical night they have together in Vienna. And then they separate, and the next film picks up like 9 years later. They haven't met since that night, and they meet again in Paris. And then the third film is like another 9 years after that, I think. So it's a bit like the Boyhood, but the film Boyhood, which is kind of playing with the idea of actually shooting over a long period of time. But yeah, Before Sunset, they're in their early to mid 30s. I was quite depressed when I realized I think I'm older than those characters now, because they seemed so grown up to me the first time I watched it. Ethan Hawke's character has written a book about the first time they met, and he's in Paris for a book tour promoting this book. And
it's Shakespeare and Company in the beginning.
And she turns up at the reading at Shakespeare and Company, the bookshop. Yeah. And she turns up, and they walk around Paris and talk and kind of reignite their romance. And I think for me, it was like, I found it very romantic. Like it was, I guess it had a big impact on the kind of what I thought love could be, or what I thought that I was looking for from life.
Yeah. You know? It's a very realistic love story. I mean, and also just the characters are very well defined and mature.
Yeah. I mean, it's very realistic. I think it is realistic in some ways and kind of fairy tale in others. Like it's realistic in the sense that it is almost in real time. Although not in real space, like if you've ever been to Paris, you definitely can't walk that route that they do. Yeah, and it's realistic about, you know, they're each coming to, they've each grown up somewhat and grown into a new sort of perspective. In some ways, they're both disillusioned, they're both unhappy in life, and yeah. So it's not kind of fairy tale in that sense. I think it kind of plays into the idea that there's this like one magical person that that is out there for you. But yeah, I think it had an impact on me. It may have made me move to Paris. I moved to Paris for a few months.
Made you go into railing too, I think, because I remember you going on about it a lot around the time that you then went on the summer rail trip throughout Europe. to try and
find. Yeah, I think I spent a lot of my late teens, early 20s, just hoping that I would run into Julie Delpy on a train, basically.
I think we've all had that dream.
Yeah. Because I went into railing after my A-levels, and then I also lived in Paris for a bit and worked in Paris for a bit. I kind of made a point of going to all the locations in the film at one time or another. I mean, Shakespeare and Company is quite an iconic bookshop anyway.
It's so fucking crowded these days, though. It's ridiculous. They have that charming little secondhand bookshop next to it, and they have to close it when it gets too busy because all the crowds are there. I was there last year. Got me all cross. Anyway, you know what? I have to confession time. I've not seen any of these films.
Oh, sorry. Well, I really, really recommend them. I think...
Yeah. No, I know. They've been on my list forever.
Yeah.
They're all kind of... it's really interesting how, again, talking about tone, how the tone shifts. And the third film, I have only seen once. I saw it in the cinema before midnight. And I'm not sure I'll watch it again just because it's like quite painful. It's got a very realistic depiction of an argument.
It's quite heavy, like towards the end of the film. It does go into a very, it's not like brutal, but it's very sort of like, oof. I don't know if we should. If it's, you almost feel like you're in the room with them. It's like, I think we should.
Kind of thing. It's a little bit like. I haven't read this, but the Harper Lee book Ghost at a Watchman, the sequel to To Kill a Mockingbird, which I didn't read because I didn't want it to like shatter my sense of who Atticus Finch was. And I think, you know, there's maybe a little bit of that with Before Midnight, but. No, it's a brilliant film, and it's just very sweet and simple, but like amazing performances, very naturalistic performances. They're both just kind of utterly inhabiting the characters, it definitely fed my romantic side quite a bit.
There's a film that I want to recommend to you both, which I have seen, and I love, which kind of almost as if it anticipates this trilogy and distorts it. It's a play that was turned into a TV film by Stephen Polyakov called Caught on a Train. Ooh. You would love this, Ed, if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, I loved it.
And it's a very young Michael Kitchen plays this sort of cynical early 80s sort of status and money obsessed British kind of corporate salesman or something who gets on a train and falls into this immediate sort of rapport and sort of potentially kind of flirty back and forth with an American traveler, and you know they're going all the way to Vienna and some similar thing, but then the whole thing gets upended by this formidable Austrian elderly woman played by Peggy Ashcroft, who's amazing, and so she sort of torpedoes what sort of tiny crumbs of a potential relationship he has with this young American woman, and then sort of becomes, he's unable to like escape her throughout this sort of, so this journey becomes a sort of nightmare, but a very, very sweet film in the end, but without sort of becoming saccharine at any point. Really good fun.
Shades of the Lady Vanishes, it sounds like as well.
Interestingly, there's even like some peril with like some Bader-Meinhof adjacent stuff at one point, but that does nowhere near as silly as I just made it sound. It's a very, very lovely film, and I feel like there is, you know, again, it plays with the romance of European travel, and interestingly that one goes out of its way to kind of paint the American tourist in this sort of negative light. Like she's at one point sort of complaining about how dirty and confusing everything is, and you're sort of meant to, as the viewer, see her as being, you know, wrong, and you know, bloody Yanks coming over here with their preconceptions. And anyway, I need to see those films, and you've just made me more keen to do so.
Yeah, they're great. I think I was around 17 or 18 when I did watch Before, when it was just the first two films, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. And I mean, it was nice that we got Before Midnight to kind of cap off the trilogy, but I always kind of feel like it was nice it kind of ended on a slight cliffhanger where you could kind of make your own assumptions about what happens to those two. And I thought that was quite nice, but it was still nice to get, but you know, Before Midnight, because I think that's a very, very good film as well. And I do think Richard Linklater is a very, I think he's a really, really good director. And I like the way he captures human drama, or just the way he's very good at capturing people and youth, especially in like a lot of his early films, like Dazed and Confused, and even something so obscure like Suburbia.
Yeah, there's a real earnestness to his films, and I think certainly to the before films. Like, they're not, they're artful and they're well made, but they're very kind of wholesome in a way, like very heart on your sleeve, in a way that risks being uncool, you know. And I think, again, I like that in films where they're not trying to be cool. Like Ethan Hawke is, to me, the definition of someone who doesn't, like, he is cool, but he's also like incredibly earnest.
Did you see his turn as John Brown in the Good Lord Bird, this mini series that came out a couple of years ago?
No,
I still need to watch that. No, I haven't. He's
amazing. I mean, that has, it's not perfect, but it's a pretty good, I really liked it. As someone who knows the history a little bit, I really loved some of the choices they made, but he is a treat as John Brown. Like, he lets it all go. And it revealed sides of him that I've never seen before. And I've always liked him as an actor, but that was really astounding. You know, anyone making art, or anyone making anything really, needs a couple of resources. They need a lot of time. They need money.
True.
But they also need focus and the ability to focus. So if you're unable to focus because, you know, making art is stressful, making anything is stressful, you know, you might turn to energy drinks. But what if they make you more jittery? Every time I've had an energy drink, I have felt like an absolute just nightmare person. I felt ill. I felt hyper. That's too sugary. It tastes awful. Coffee, that's better, isn't it? Yes.
Yep.
But if you're drinking coffee to feel focused, not as like a leisurely thing to do in a cafe, you might also have a few problems. It can make you feel acid. It can also make you feel a bit on edge. It's bad for your heart in larger quantities. So, you know, I was, like many people, searching around for something that would just make my mornings and my whole day a little bit better. And I found the wonderful folks at Magic Mind. It's this tiny little mental performance shot. And I was like, look at that, mental performance shot. I need that. And it's green and it's got natural sources of caffeine and it's all beautifully packaged and everything else. I drank it, tasted good. It didn't make me feel like I just had a horrible energy drink, and I didn't feel like I needed more. I had the right amount to get through my day, because it was giving me mental energy and it was improving my sleep. So, you know, all of this, I was getting stuff done and then I was sleeping better as a result. And it just became the self-perpetuating cycle, helped along by that little, you know, Magic Mind mental performance shot. They specifically brand themselves as a mental performance shot, which I think sounds a lot cooler. As I mentioned, all natural ingredients, like matcha. We love a bit of matcha. We're a couple of matcheral guys. We also like ashwagandha, which has been used medicinally since 6000 BC, which is also really fun to say. Ashwagandha. It's an adaptogen that reduces stress and anxiety, in case you were wondering. Ashwagandha. It also contains lots of other lovely ingredients, lots of different types of mushrooms that can do wonderful stuff to your mind and to your body. So look, you should try Magic Mind, and you should try it with a discount, because you know, A, it might help you take the plunge, and B, if you for some reason don't like Magic Mind, then you'll feel less terrible about having spent the money, which is not a lot. Look, go to www.magicmind.com/homes, H-O-L-M-E-S. Use the very special offer code HOMES20, H-O-L-M-E-S-2-0, and you will get up to 48% off your subscription for the next 10 days if you order using that offer code. So do it soon. Look, guys, everyone needs a little help, right? We can't do it on our own. We can't just get through this late stage capitalistic nightmare that we're all living through without a little boost. But why give money to those awful energy drink companies? Why participate in the coffee Olympics when you could just get on board the Magic Mind train, which runs on Magic Mind, which means it's more efficient. And it's being, you know, it's being talked about by lots of people who aren't us. Surfers like it. Someone called Koa Rothman. Someone, whatever that name is, a surfer. Nate Florence. These are surfers. They talk about Magic Mind on their surfing, I imagine, podcast. So surfers like it. Surfers are cool dudes. You should like it too. And you'll be surfing the waves of productivity and calm. So please, as I say, go to www.magicmind.com/homes and use the offer code HOMES20 to get 48% off your subscription. Magic Mind. Reclaim your brain.
You're ahead of me every time. My route's already mapped out in your mind. Seeing patterns in what I do. Before it happens, you anticipate my move. Am I so predictable? Such an old. It's a little creepy how clearly you see me. Getting kinda spooky, looking right through me. I'm a little scared to be read of letting you into my head. I try talking in cryptic clues. Circumlocution just doesn't work on you. Your intuition won't let me hide from your x-ray vision as I try to keep inside the soft, the vulnerable, undefended heart. It's a little creepy.
Anyway, number three, what do we got?
Okay, okay, so I think next one I'm gonna do is Phantom Thread.
Interesting.
Which I also have not seen.
Interesting.
Oh, okay,
choice.
Great. Oh, I got you.
Yeah.
And as I assume you have seen it.
I have seen it. I would like to sort of say I liked it, but I don't love it. I think I have a very sort of love-hate relationship with Paul Thomas Anderson, the director. It's like, I don't know, the way I kind of describe it, it's like that scene in Finding Nemo when he's like, everyone's like, oh, a clownfish, go on, tell us a joke. And they're all like smiling where he's trying to tell this joke about a snail and a mollusk. And then their smiles sort of fade away. And that's kind of how I am with Paul Thomas Anderson's films. I kind of go into them being like, this is going to be great. I've heard so many good things about it. And then by the end of it, I'm like, okay. I mean, I like Boogie Nights. I thought The Master was really good.
There Will Be Blood?
He did do There Will Be Blood. I'm not so big on There Will Be Blood.
Oh, okay. That's it. Yeah, because I love There Will Be Blood. I didn't get to see Phantom Thread. But why don't we let Ed tell us why he likes it?
Yeah, but sorry, I just wanted to get my sort of things out of the way. But I'm curious to hear what you have to say about the film.
Yeah, well, why did I choose it? So it's, partly, I suppose, all the other films on my list are quite sweet and happy. And kind of about love and warm and fuzzies, and this is very not that. It's a love story, and it's a story about domesticity and home, I suppose, but like a real dark side to it, which there's a little bit on my record as well, as a kind of counterweight to all the cozy sweet stuff. It's basically a two-hander between Daniel Day-Lewis and Vicky Creeps, who are both brilliant. Maybe not her first role, but certainly her first major, you know, she was kind of a bit like Robin Wright in The Princess Bride. She kind of came out of nowhere and starred in this film. And she's such an amazing counterweight. Like she kind of easily is a match for Daniel Day-Lewis in this film. There is a sense that they're competing. The characters are, there's a power tussle between the characters the whole time. He plays this Savile Row tailor or like dressmaker called Reynolds Woodcock in the 50s, and she is this waitress who he kind of takes on as his muse, and it seems initially like there's just this very dominant dynamic where he has all the power, but then over the film it's about her kind of getting in the ascendancy, almost like it has a, so some of the things I love about it are the performances. The score is absolutely phenomenal. It's a Johnny Greenwood score, and I think it's one of my favorite film scores of all time, and one of the few that I will kind of listen to in its own right, you know, out of the context of the film. It also has some wonderful non-score music, you know, some old jazz tunes and things that are incorporated very smoothly into the soundtrack. It creates, yeah, this kind of oppressive sense of this big London townhouse where Reynolds Woodcock has his studio, is this space that's kind of very beautiful but also very menacing at times, and it feels kind of, it has Mark Kermode talked when he was reviewing it, I remember, talked about the fairy tale elements. It has a real sense of like, he's almost like this fairy tale monster, the character. He's very softly spoken and very sort of fastidious, but he's got a little bit of Bluebeard or the Beast or something. Like he's kind of an ogre, and she's sort of the princess in the tower, but with a lot more agency than your kind of Princess Buttercup. It's a very strange film. It left me with a lot of like questions.
It left me feeling a little bit cold, because I mean, I probably have to watch it again, or maybe I maybe have to see it in a different sort of context. But yeah, I do get what you mean. And also the fairy tale aspect does make a lot of sense given what he is. And also just like, he has his things that he likes. He wants his breakfast to be quiet and he can ruminate and all this other stuff, and how everything's supposed to work around the shop. And then there's like one scene sort of going into sort of the second half of the film where she kind of interrupts that, Vicky Pierce's character. And it's such, and you just know something bad's about to happen. And I think it's a good scene. I really like that scene a lot, even though I'm not too big on the film, but it's such a good build up to where just, it's just two actors are just competing against each other. And it's just, it's very well done.
There's it also like, from listening to, I listened to an interview with Paul Thomas Anderson when he was talking about it. And he sort of co-wrote it with Daniel Day-Lewis, or at least Daniel Day-Lewis was very involved in the original story concept and coming up with the character and so on. And from the sounds of it, they were really kind of giggling when they wrote it. Like there's a lot of like, they were just having a lot of fun. And so like, you know, Reynolds Woodcock is a really silly name, and that was sort of on purpose. And there's the first scene where they meet, where Daniel Day-Lewis and Vicky Creeps' characters meet, is this scene where she's taking a breakfast order from him, and it's the most absurd breakfast order. It's like, I have a Welsh rabbit with a poached egg on top, not too runny, bacon, scones, cream, butter, jam, not strawberry, and pot of tea. Do you have lapsang? I'll have lapsang. And sausages.
That's a very good impression of him, actually. That's a very good impression.
I actually went to university with Daniel Day-Lewis's nephew, and he speaks just like him. So I feel like that gave me an advantage.
It's the last. I was just looking at his filmography. That's the last film.
Yes. Well, and so what I've heard is that basically, having had this kind of jolly time writing the film, when he did his Daniel Day-Lewis thing and kind of went deep into the character and realized, oh, this is actually like a really horrible, sinister story. And I'm not laughing anymore. It sort of like freaked him out. And he was like, okay, I think I might be done. Like I've heard that there's sort of an element of that to his decision to retire. I don't know how true that is. But it is.
But he's retired before, you know,
Well, I mean, he's not one of these actors who just does like a film every year. It's just like there's always like a big break in between. And I think it's like, I feel like maybe
he'll do another.
He's done what he's set out to do, maybe. But yeah.
He'll do one more. Mark my words. He'll come back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. Martin Scorsese made a slight little thing about it when he was getting an award, saying like, oh, I made two films with Daniel Day-Lewis and they were two of the best experiences of my life. Maybe there's a third one. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to hope so. He's not that old.
No. There's a great anecdote from the making of The Last of the Mohicans where the great Cherokee actor playing the baddie in that, Wes Studi, said to Daniel Day-Lewis, oh, you know, I can't remember if it was his wife or his child or some other relative is a huge fan. I'd love to get your autograph. And Daniel Day-Lewis was like, all right, then I'll do your autograph. And he was like, but you have to do it with your left foot because of the movie that he'd been in before. So, and he did.
And he got it. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So I love that. I feel like there's, for all the, like, he's a nutter and a method actor and all the rest of it, I'm sure that there's way more. There can only be way more sort of actually good and interesting things to say about him because, like, the choices he's made in his career have been very deliberate and very interesting, and there's no performance of his, even if the film is not great, that doesn't at least sort of resonate with you afterwards. And did he ever do much stage work?
He famously pulled out of a run of Hamlet, and
I was just about to bring this up. Yeah, I was just about to bring this up.
I can't remember why, but I think it was, it might have been,
I heard Tim Roth was talking about it on like some GQ thing where he was talking about his career. And apparently it was like, cause he got so deep into the role of Hamlet that he thought he saw his own dead father. And I think he had to like back out of the play.
I mean, so Phantom Thread, I think, is one of the things that I take from it is sort of a cautionary tale about being an artist, which I think is so relevant to that, you know, to like Daniel Day-Lewis going so deep into his roles, because he's, you know, he creates this environment. The character who's this wonderful dressmaker, although actually to a modern eye his dresses look kind of ugly, but like he creates this environment where everything has to be just so. And he becomes this real tyrant about it. And it's kind of a good cautionary tale to anyone who's making creative work to, like, I don't know, just like chill out and be kind and not be a monster. I think it's possible to kind of lean into that dark side of just everything having to be just so. For the sake of your work, but I don't know, human relationships are more important, I think.
Yeah, it made me think of Whiplash and the way that Fletcher, J.K. Simmons' character, is like in Whiplash as well, the way that he sort of pushes people to, you know, to be the better than they already are and trying to find the next, you know, Buddy Rich or Charlie Parker or the next jazz artist. And I think, you know, I mean, also a very fascinating character as well. I mean, a very, like, frightening character, but a very fascinating one.
Yeah.
With an interesting, you know, there's some very, I mean, you understand what he's doing, but you don't agree with the methods of what he's doing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's sort of, I think in both the case of Whiplash and Phantom Thread, it's sort of it's kind of bullying that's dressed up as artistic perfectionism, you know, or at least you can make the case that it is, that it's kind of got nothing to do with art. Actually, it's just bullying.
have you ever had experience with anyone like that in your profession? Like, or just,
yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people, I mean, to the Whiplash thing, I know plenty of people that had bad experiences at music college, although they would have been, you know, some of the detail in Whiplash is kind of not quite right. But I think, in terms of capturing that sort of personality, there are definitely people like that working at music colleges. I think, yeah, I've experienced people being assholes, and I think that it's not, it's never worth it, you know. It's just not worth it, and I don't want to work with people like that.
Yeah, I've worked with some people on sets, like on film sets, and sometimes people have, you know, you come to set and they make it feel like you want to be there, and everyone's like, yeah, we're having fun, we're making a film, and sometimes it's like, then there's the opposite side of that where it's just like, I'm not enjoying this because every, you know, this person's kind of a dick, or like everything has, it's just, it's, it, you know, sort of, they sort of take the fun out of, you know, being creative. I mean, it's a difficult environment, and, you know, there's, you know, time, and you got to get certain things done, but like,
yeah,
it can still be fun as well.
Yeah.
And it's like, anytime when someone like raises their voice or just like shouts, then it's just like, I don't want to be here. I just want to make sure we can, you know, just get everything done and then get out of here as quick as possible, kind of thing.
Yeah. I think there's no excuse for it, really. And it's, I mean, I definitely notice in the session work that I do, the responsibility of the kind of conductors or composers or producers or whoever's running the session, how much their vibe can dictate everyone else's experience and enjoyment. And I do think you get much better results by just being nice.
True. Yeah.
So yeah,
it really is amazing how often it just comes down to that in life. And just,
yeah,
like, all the trainings, all the workshops that people can send you to about management and about this and that, and it's just like, just be nice and you,
yeah,
will be amazed how,
yeah, yeah, try saying that to Stanley Kubrick.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing, because I think there are as many examples of where a person's like thoroughgoing, just like they're like this all the time, perfectionism or tyrannical approach to art, call it what you will, you know, just breaks through as an example of like, aha, see, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
But I think correlation doesn't necessarily equal causation.
Exactly.
I think
they could have had fun making Kubrick films as well.
Yeah, sure. I reckon so. But I don't know. Well, I'm not Stanley Kubrick, so I don't know. Famously, I'm not.
Yeah. So okay. Well. What's in at number four? Or like, not
okay.
This isn't a list, I guess, of. You know, this isn't a ranked list, but what's your fourth film, Ed?
Yeah, so I'm gonna bring it home with another film that I can quote more than any other, except The Princess Bride, which is It's a Wonderful Life.
Ah.
I think it feels kind of seasonally inappropriate to talk about it in April, but
sort of warm.
Yeah,
it's
the best Christmas movie. It's just the most heartwarming film ever, and having talked about all the negative vibes of Phantom Thread, I think it's the ultimate feel good film, really.
It's one of the most humanistic Hollywood films, I think, major Hollywood films. It is such a document for me of the best of Roosevelt era America in terms of its ethos, its heart. You know, the fact that It shows a community spirit, a sense of outrage at systemic inequality, and, you know, a kind of celebration secular values, but that are somehow kind of associated with kind of American culture. The way in which all of those things are done at the same time is really remarkable, because it almost feels like a film about America that was made outside of America, but intending to seem like it was made in America. You know, there's somehow a sense, yeah, of outsiderness looking in. And then I think a lot of that comes from Capra, maybe, and his personality, but and his the chip he had on his shoulder. But like, it just amazes me at every viewing how much, not exactly subversive, but how unusually punchy it is,
yes,
about certain things.
It consistently surprises me, and I used to watch it every Christmas. I think I've certainly taken a few years off because I felt that it was getting to that point, a bit like I said about The Princess Bride, where I almost couldn't see the film anymore. Like I couldn't see through my own layered previous viewings to actually like experience it in the moment. But yeah, I'm consistently surprised by how dark it gets. People talk about some of James Stewart's performances, like in Vertigo, for instance, of really subverting the kind of folksy all-American persona that he'd built up. But he goes dark in It's a Wonderful Life before it comes back around again. Like he really plumbs the depths of despair, and he's like horrible to the people around him. And yeah, it really pulls back from the precipice. And I think people remember the folksy fun bits of the film, and they remember the ending, but it's really easy to forget how deep it goes, you know, how dark it goes. It's very patiently constructed, like just getting darker and darker. And yeah, I think it's a brilliant film.
I mean, you and I have both been known to bust out a James Stewart from time to time. I'm sure Anders.
Hey, what do you mean?
But there's something in his performances in these films that there's this like a moment, and it feels so not of its time, this form of acting, where he becomes this kind of gasping, sort of hysteric, you know, when he's at a moment of high stress, whether it's in this film. I also think of there's a brilliant scene in, he did these very dark westerns for Anthony Mann in the 50s, and there's one in there's a scene where he fights someone in the film Winchester 73, where his face becomes contorted in this sort of moment of sort of rage and desperation. And he could do something quite incredible with his sort of physicality, or his already quite unusual physicality, to really make you feel this, like the rawness of his emotions. And it's interesting, you know, we say, oh, he was known for this and he was known for that. I feel like nowadays, because of the films that have kind of endured with James Stewart, they're all he may have, you any viewer coming new to James Stewart now watching his like top hits on Letterboxd or IMDb would be convinced that he was like the go-to kind of angsty, like tortured male lead, but that's what's so great about the way Hitchcock, Anthony Mann and others used him. They found that side within him, and it's again interesting that in this film you have a guy playing someone who did not go away and fight, but he's played by one of the few Hollywood actors, Hollywood stars, who really not only went away and served, but went away and was in harm's way and in combat and, you know, suffered terrible trauma, I'm sure, as a result. And you feel the...
See that on his face.
This is it. Hmm?
You can see that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The same thing happened to William Holden, I think. But the film for me is an incredible, as I say, it's a post-war film as much as anything else, but it's also this little window of maybe a what could have been as America heads into the Cold War, and suddenly the films, this film would not have been made in the late 40s or early, certainly not the early 50s. It is too socialist, you know, for want of a better word.
It feels so of a moment, doesn't it? Because when did it come out? 46?
Yeah, I think so.
But it goes right up to VJ Day, you know, like and shortly afterwards, it's literally like slam. Like it's as if a film about COVID-19 was coming out in 2022. You know, like which some films did do that, but it would feel very on the nose, wouldn't it? It makes me, I mean, there's so many films that have referenced it, and I know what I was going to say. Well, I went to a town called Indiana, Pennsylvania, which is confusingly in Pennsylvania, not Indiana, which is James Stewart's hometown. And
I love that he's from Indiana, Pennsylvania.
That's brilliant. Could not be more folksy, kind of Midwestern. The whole town has got like sort of statues everywhere, and there's a little museum, and it's a very Bedford Falls feeling kind of little town. And yeah, it's we had a gig, a swingles gig there, but
you and must have been unbearable for the duration of that stage.
I mean,
But I every think time it was you see a James Stewart day, statue, oh, what do you know?
The next day we drove through Punxsutawney as well.
Oh, Jesus.
So yeah, it was like film references a go-go. What was I going to say? Oh yeah, like the Truman Show. I always think there's like a lot of those films have a lot in common, or there's a big, because essentially the whole movie is George Bailey is trying to leave this town.
Yes.
And things keep pulling him back, like his network of obligations and the fact that he's just too nice, or like too, he's too aware of his obligations to his community and his family to be able to just go traveling, get on a train to Vienna and meet some French girl. And so, yeah, it's very much like the Truman Show, but with a kind of more benign thing. And actually some of that style of acting that you were talking about, I almost think of Jim Carrey as being a kind of a modern equivalent in a way of like having this quite broad physicality. It's not a subtle performance, is it, as George Bailey, but it feels so real, like every beat is so kind of deeply felt.
And there are just moments of just the touching stuff in there, like that scene at the beginning where she leans into his deaf ear and confesses her love for him and the child. I mean, that's like, it's so utterly perfectly done. It's like it's the exact right level of Hollywood sugar poured on. It's just, you know, there's nothing that's sort of overegged. And they're walking a tightrope because this film features angels, for God's sake. Like, it's not, you know, it could go so catastrophically wrong.
I think you realize on rewatching it as well how lean it is, in the sense that there's almost no detail of his life that we see in the first two thirds of the film that that doesn't have a bearing on the last third. In other words, everything he does in the first two thirds then gets undone in the second third in the world, you know, what if he'd never been born? And so it's a very like patient kind of accumulation of detail that then all does pay off, in a way that kind of is almost like so clever that you don't notice it.
No, absolutely. And the other thing that I always think about with this film is just the sheer richness of its cast. I mean, you've got not just Stewart and Donna Reed in the leads, but Thomas Mitchell is amazing and was so just prolific either side of the war and then kind of faded away. But one of the great character actors, I think of Gloria Graham as kind of the bad guy. I love her and everything she's in. Interestingly, when the AFI did the American Film Institute did their 100 years, 100 movies, you know, a few years ago, it's like the equivalent of the Sight and Sound top 100, but just for American films, because, you know, who needs other kinds of films? The actor with the most credits across that list of the top 100 films was Ward Bond, who plays the policeman in this one, just because he's in so many films for so many. He was a John Ford regular in all these westerns. He was in he was in other Capra movies, of course, and Preston Sturges films and God knows what else. And, you know, he did in the Maltese Falcon. It's so funny. I discovered this through doing a Sporkle quiz and it was driving me crazy. Like, who's this guy with 13 credits?
So I think you'll need to fact check this, but I think that Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street were named after Bert and Ernie, who are the cop and cab driver.
Oh, I could believe that. I don't want to fact check that because if it's not true, I'll be angry.
But it should be true.
Yeah, exactly.
That could be our Trivia Tuesday post. If it's true.
Oh, well done, Anders. It is Tuesday tomorrow. It's your eyes on the prize, as always. So that's for our Instagram. That's such a good film. I think I didn't watch it as a child. I probably would have been too. It's the kind of film I would have shied away from as a child because it is such an emotional hit. The last time I watched it, Anders was with me and will attest that I sobbed at the end.
I think we both did.
Yeah, I think we did. Yeah, because
that was the first time I'd watched it, and it was during Christmas of that year when the whole world just went to shit. And it was just after
you'd have to narrow that down now. I think you mean 2020.
2020. But yeah, it was just like, it was after the election, and it was just like, it was kind of like, we were sort of, things were, I don't know, it was just, it was a very weird emotional experience watching that film at that time of the year.
Absolutely. And we all kind of reassessed a lot of things in that year, including what was important to us, and you know, what family and community meant, and also what home meant. And just to kind of bring it back to my big theme, I do think that, like, I was actually surprised that home as a theme, like, didn't necessarily come up in when I thought about my favorite films. I've sort of tried to pick films that did, but I do think that it's like a classic image of home, like that final scene where they're around the Christmas tree and everyone's kind of piling in.
That sense of, I mean, how many times have we seen that in films, of a community suddenly being in someone's house and everyone being happy?
Yeah.
And it was even used, Biden used it in a campaign video a video in conjunction with the Democratic convention that summer. It was where he was on his own, and then all of a sudden the room is filled with grandchildren and dogs and God knows what else. It was just fucking hokey as shit. And like, this is a different thing. It is a moment of like healing, because it's a broken home that these people have come into, and it is a home of hurt and pain that suddenly is salved by, and Stuart's face in that scene is so moving as well, because, you know, it is this, he's almost sort of panting with the sheer you know, strain of it all. And it's so different from the very, very many imitators that have tried to you know, build on this idea. And it's just because I think to do this stuff well, you've got to have, I mean, kind of references something you were saying earlier, you've got to have the bravery to also plumb the dark stuff to you know, you've got to present the full spectrum of feeling for good art.
You once called me a warped, frustrated old man.
now you're branching out.
That's right.
I think I actually, given the choice, I actually prefer doing a Lionel Barrymore impression. I'm not claiming that it's good, but it's very fun to do.
That is good. And I don't think there's as much of a market for or there is a market for it, as in, because I think the Stuart market is saturated with impressionists, and many of them are bad. But no, that was very good. I liked I like it.
Peter Bailey was a fine man, but he was no businessman. It's so great.
There are people who think that we quote too many films on this podcast. And
that we do,
and I love that you've just come in and just added to that, because I love pissing that particular demographic of listeners off. Brilliant. What a list. And so remind us again about the release date and the title of your album, please.
My album Homing Instinct comes out on May 17th 2024. Please enjoy it, and please enjoy these wonderful films.
Yes. And also to say that there might be things happening for, I don't know, people that live in London or thereabouts, for them enjoy.
If you're in London, I have a release show at Crazy Cox in Soho on the 21st of May. It's going to be really fun. A full band show. We'll do all this stuff from the album. I can't wait.
And if people want to keep up with what you're up to as an artist, as a musician, what's the best place? Is it your website, social media, all of the above?
Yeah, you can sign up to my mailing list on my website. That's where you get the real sweet stuff. But you can also follow me on Instagram and YouTube and everything, at Edward Randall, and that's RANDELL.
And we'll put all of this information in the show notes. So, well, Ed, thank you so much for coming on. And
my absolute pleasure.
movies and talking about your wonderful album. Yeah, good luck with it, and good luck with the show. When I wish I could go, but it's a little far from where I am now. I just googled that it is a 7.5-hour drive to Indiana, Pennsylvania. So I won't be able to make it today because of the daycare pickup, but I might try and do a quick pilgrimage tomorrow. But do enjoy that, and know that I'll be with you in spirit, buddy. When the album hits the big time, get yourself over here to Northampton. Our like legendary music venue in town just reopened. So
I always see some of my favorite artists. They tend to make a stop in Northampton. I always think of you.
There you go.
And didn't I almost Steve Earle go. Steve Earle played there, didn't he?
Yes, I went to see Steve Earle years ago. I'm going to see this summer. John Fogerty.
Oh, so now you can see John Fogerty.
I can actually see him do a youth source. Anyway, no, this is an old strife between me and my brother. Anyway, irrelevant. We'll let you go. Ed, thank you so much. Give my love to everyone, and we'll chat soon.
Speak soon.
Yeah.
Blow the roof off my heart. But maybe we're happy ever after. Finding fault, you could be the sweetest. I'd want more salt, looking for perfection. Had me looking in the wrong direction. Maybe we're happy ever after, after. Suddenly I know what I had to do. Must have been a step I skipped. Understanding we could write our own script. Maybe we're happy ever after, after all. Happy ever after, after all. It's breaking. Sleeping.